Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Cal Thomas, a sales performance expert, coach, and longtime Sandler training leader. For more than 25 years, Cal has been helping business owners, sales leaders, and professionals master the art and science of selling. His clients range from Fortune 100 companies to family-owned businesses, all seeking the same thing: consistent, scalable, and predictable growth. What makes Cal's perspective especially relevant to our audience is his experience working with family-governed businesses that often rely on word-of-mouth relationships or good order-taking, but struggle with building a proactive, structured sales culture. Cal, welcome to Growing Up B2B. It's great to have you today.
Hey, Ed. I've been hearing about this for a long time and know about your work with family-owned businesses, so it's very happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Awesome. So let's start with your story, Cal. You actually worked in your family's business early on, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
We did, Ed, for a while. By the way, that was a great Sandler-style introduction for those who recognize it. That was nice work. So we had a lot of family businesses. I was part of one of them, which was my father. My father was in a family business. They were the main stack ballet in the Thomas School of Dance. Fast forward a lot of years, I went to work with him in his consulting practice. And our job was to get, you've probably heard this program is brought to you by a grant from Mobile Corporation.
Okay.
So our job was to go find funders and underwriters for television and radio production. So we did for a while.
Oh, wow. Okay. So in that experience, talk a bit about what did that teach you about the dynamics of working with family or how families make or sometimes avoid challenges or tough business decisions, or I'll just say issues.
Issues, yeah. We were pretty lucky. I probably have better examples of other people, but of course I would say that.
Yeah.
So holidays were, we avoided all that stuff. And we didn't tend to have tough conversations.
Okay.
So that was a problem. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been doing it for 30 minutes. Of course, I'm a genius. I knew everything. Not the case. He did teach me how to cold call CEOs of large companies. So we generally had a good relationship, but we weren't really direct with each other.
I see. Okay. But they're not unlike so many of our guests who have grown up around a family business. There was definitely some influencing going on. You were watching your dad, you were being influenced by some of the things he did. And so to some people, the idea of calling upon a large company CEO is terrifying to you. It's like, it's just what we do.
Yeah. I will say, having that experience, it was very easy to recognize when family businesses had that same challenge we had. They weren't willing to address the tough issues. And the more the family members in the business, usually the more avoidance came. On the other hand, and I haven't seen a lot of middle ground. The others sometimes just really address conflict really hard.
Okay. Bringing this around to the family-run companies that you encounter as part of your Sandler practice. One thing that I've noticed, and maybe you have too, but a lot of times they're really good at building strong relationships, but not so good at building strong, what I'll call sales systems or processes. So when you first walk into a business and you realize, okay, this is a family dynamic, there's either multiple people in the family involved, or it's a husband and wife team or some other family dynamic, what are some of the patterns that you look for or see when you first walk in and start that engagement process?
Yeah, I love that one. And you, as a Sandler guy, know maybe what my answer is going to be. I don't think I'm going to surprise you much today, but I go in being curious. Do I kind of know what to expect? I do. But if I go in to your business ad and say, look, you and your father and your brother and your cousin, you guys need to sit down. We need to do some communication training, and here's the process you need to follow. They're going to go, you don't have any idea what's going on. So my job is to be curious. Tell me a little bit about the role that your father's playing now. Tell me a little more about your cousin. Sounds like she's been doing a great job. And just being very inquisitive for pretty much the whole first conversation, and then asking what is it they really want to accomplish. And I find it takes people's guards down. They're willing to tell me a little bit more. Because if I come in with a solution, right or wrong, they're not going to like it.
Of course. So I got another question, which kind of touches on what we just spoke about relative to some of the influence that your dad may have had imparted on you, and certainly the influences that my father imparted on me. And that's the way a lot of second or third or even fourth gens grew up in the business, watching their higher parent or whatever by instinct. So how do you convince those leaders that when you introduce process, such as sales process, that doesn't kill the authenticity? It actually enhances it, as you just gave a little example of. How do you break that down, though?
I love that one as well. You asked relationships. So all of the first generation, or maybe it's second generation, they figure out how to have really good relationships. And they do that. Is that passed on to the next generation? Or their relationships, depending on how long they've been in the business? I'll say, let's pretend, Zach, that your father's going to be here for another, I don't even know how many years. You said 3 to 4. He said 20. We'll figure that one out. Let's pretend he does want to go play more golf and do more fishing. What are your relationships or conversations that you're going to be having with them? And then I'll let them try and answer, and they're not able to answer, frankly. Mm. So it's suggestive. Again, it's about asking questions. And getting them, we have a rule in Sandler Ad, which you probably know, people can't argue with their own data. So if I can uncover the problem that they have, and they're willing to tell me, hey, look, I'm really afraid that all the relationships that my father had, I don't have them. And when he's gone, we're in trouble. And then that leads to a process kind of discussion.
That's a great point and a great thought too, because we often get engaged with a company on that generational transition. And the reason is the leadership is changing, but along that journey, so has the customer audience, the buying trends, the competitive landscape, and so many other things, much as you're bringing to light. There's a whole new generation of people that are potential buyers that are rising up too, who may or may not have that legacy relationship with the parental figure, right? And they've got to be, they're new, right? So we got to approach them in new ways.
And you're from with the overused comment, what got you here isn't what's going to get you there.
Absolutely.
And I'd love to ask what their goals are. Mm-hmm. And oh, I want to keep this going with the family. I'm not sure that's a quantifiable goal. So we spend a lot of time, as I know you do. What are your goals? What's your end game? What is it you want to accomplish?
I got it. So I got another question for you. And this one, I've been excited to hear your response because I hear it too. A lot of business owners say to you, Cal, we don't really sell. Our customers just come to us. What's your reaction when you hear that?
Yeah, you'll hear me say this probably two or three times today. So tell me a little more about what you mean by that. And I did have a great client and they're a lot of fun. We'll call them two siblings, and the business was started by the grandfather. And when I asked these questions, they about relationships, about process, about customers come to us. It turns out that is exactly what happened. And the customers just came to them. And they just got purchase orders. They just got phone calls. They quite literally had no relationship with their customer base. So when we dug into goals, they told me that they wanted to grow and scale. So I asked some more questions and they looked at me and went, I guess we can't do that unless we do something differently. Like maybe we have to get out there. And those guys actually became pretty decent sellers for existing customers growing and going out and finding new ones. Mm. So it was work because it wasn't their natural skill set. It wasn't what their grandfather did or father did or they did, but it's working because they're doing the work.
Yeah. I remember early on when my dad and I overlapped, and this was a little bit of the internet was just coming, commercializations, a website just coming, but just not quite there yet. So a lot of times we'd look through trade ads and he said, look at this company. They're positioned all wrong. They're selling all wrong. He said, we should call them. I said, great, let's do that. And I'm looking at him and he's looking at me. I'm like, aren't we going to call them? He said, I don't have time for it. It was the first time it occurred to me, you don't want to call them. All right, give me the phone. I'll call them. And I did. And they said, now we're happy with what we're doing. And I was like, okay. It was the first time I realized that my dad was great with relationships and great at a great ambassador to the business. And he absolutely was. But when it came to new business development, he was a fish out of water. And I'm sure you've run into that too.
It's funny. So we learned a lot of, we have a lot of recordings in our heads, however you record them. I record them in cassettes. People record them differently now, but we have those from 0 to 7 years old. And a couple are, hey, don't talk to strangers. And it's not polite to talk about money. And now we go into this business or inherit or buy the business. And now we have to go talk to strangers about money. And it's very uncomfortable unless you have some tools and some belief systems that support that. And there's probably one out of 40, Ed, my experience, I don't know what yours is, they're right off the cuff comfortable with that.
So this is another thing I want to hear your answer this one. When you go into a business leader and they say something along the lines of, our people aren't hunters, they're farmers. So what do you do when you hear... You probably heard that about 1,000 times, if not more. So when you hear that, what's your response to that? And to what extent can you start to work on that?
Yeah. So we've got actually 3 clients current right now, and they've got it. And in fact, they're quote salespeople who we've renamed account managers. They are indeed farmers. They don't have the ambition. They don't have the will, and they don't have the skills to hunt. In fact, we have something called the CARE model, K-A-R-E, keep, attain, recapture, and expand. So we have one client, they increased their revenue by 50% over 18 months by just expanding existing customer base. Now, which is great. However, you can't expand what you don't have. So somehow, and we're working with some of their technical folks now, how do we do some business development? Because they can't say the word sales. How do we get in front of more people? How do we do podcasts that people invite us to? Do we, so we got to sneak it in a little bit. But the answer is you can grow existing accounts minus the ones you're going to lose. But if you don't have anything new, you can't grow it.
Yeah.
And then when we get a little more comfortable, I say, tell me a little bit more about these people and why you're keeping them. Or who's an example of someone that you've seen has been a great hunter that you've met? And we compare and contrast those characteristics.
We've noticed that it's very hard to achieve substantial top line growth on just a keep strategy, to your point, because eventually there will be some degradation in the accounts or some attrition, and that pool becomes smaller and smaller if you don't keep nurturing it. And the only time I've seen it work is if, okay, it's a predominantly a keep strategy, but there's an aggressive referral ass strategy that's anchored to it. Then, okay, then sometimes it works, but really it's going after the new fish in the sea while nurturing those that you have. Because you always want to do that, right? You don't want to keep letting them fall off the back of the train, the cars. You want to keep those cars on the train, but you want to add new cars. Tricky.
I love that you brought up referral strategy, because that is part of an attain strategy that account managers can certainly do, or people that are farmers, and that's great. Now, that's, I don't tell anybody, but that's actually, we have to know business, but don't tell anybody that, just they'll lose their minds. But that's a valid strategy. But at some point, if you've made a habit of growing existing accounts, some people call it land and expand, you're gonna cap out someplace.
Yeah. Yeah.
As you said, you're gonna lose some trains off the, some cars off the train. What do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. And we also coach people that don't call it referral, call it an introduction.
Absolutely.
Because if I ask you for a referral, that sounds like work. But if I ask for an introduction, yeah, I can do introductions all day. That's no problem. Basically the same thing, but just a little bit of a twist.
And I'm with you. That's a great. We did a trap exercise in our sales mastery program. We had 18 to 22 people that day. And the trap exercise is, how many opportunities did you miss to ask for an introduction? I think we got $6.8 million in lost opportunities.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing.
It was painful because I had some too.
There you go. We all do. We all do. And it does take some coaching. because there too, sometimes the notion, especially in certain, I've noticed this in certain kind of old guard professional services firms.
Yeah.
We don't ask for that. They just give them. We don't, it's not appropriate to ask. It sounds salesy or it sounds desperate or whatever. They've got some preconceived notions. So I imagine sometimes your work is whittling that down in some way or reshaping their perspective.
Oh, for sure. There's a way to do it or a way not to. And I imagine you've been, you're part of networking organizations and have been, that's how we met, is through a network. People we knew a network together. How many people have you heard or your audience have ever heard, hey, if you know anyone that could use our services, let me know. I bet there's a 0% chance of that, maybe two. Because as soon as someone, if you know anyone, they don't have any family members, they don't have friends, they don't have business, they don't know anybody. Because they don't know what to do. So we have to help them. You're right. So there's a, it's a behavior, and there is a fair bit of technique about it and being honest.
Yeah. Yeah. I also cringe whenever I hear a consultant say, who do you work with typically? Pretty much anyone. Oh, okay.
That's helpful.
I got it. I got a clear picture now. But again, that's why you exist, Cal, is to right those wrongs and help them get on a better path.
And sometimes you can. And I might use my snarky Cal once in a while and say, and point to the person over there. Is she a good prospect for you? No, I only do men's clothing. Okay, let's work on refining that a little bit.
There you go. As you've even demonstrated, the Sandler system is built around inherently structure, accountability, but questioning techniques. When it comes to, and if you think back on some of the work you've done with family-governed businesses, what would you say is the hardest part typically for them to embrace and get on board with?
Getting everybody lined up and in agreement that there's need for change and what that change needs to look like.
Okay.
Sound like a great answer, but when you put family-based businesses in other businesses, like the technology company down the street, here's what we're doing, here's the new process, and there you're gonna, this is what we're doing. Thanks for your input. This is not a democracy. This is the way the world's gonna work starting at 2 o'clock tomorrow. For the family-owned business, it's a little bit harder to do that because it isn't part of democracy. Not suggesting it should be, but it certainly is a lot of consensus building. There's a lot of emotion. So I think agreeing there needs to be change and what that change ought to be. That's been my observation. Has yours been the same or yours might be different?
Usually there's an understanding that, yeah, that, hey, something's got to go differently, right? There's usually a lot of agreement on that, right? That something's amiss, whatever it is, something's amiss. How to attack that is often what's a question mark and what direction. Because it's rarely, oh, there's one direction and we're all aligned and it's totally clear. It's more of a discovery of, and sometimes our methodology is the right way and sometimes it isn't. And that's okay. We tell them that right up front, true to Sandler form. It's okay to say no.
All day long. And we want those. And
yeah.
Back to the family example, I don't care if they're in an org chart. Of course, there isn't one. If there were an org chart, they're not all going to be at the top, but they're all involved in the decision-making process. So part of what I insist on, 90% of the time, is we all have to get in that room and build some consensus. So I have to act as facilitator to get them talking to each other, which is great fun, and it's a lot of work. But that's the only way it's going to work easily.
Yeah, yeah. Something you've said before, and I've heard you say this, hope isn't a sales strategy. So how do you teach leaders who built success on gut instinct and old guard relationships to rely on new behaviors and new processes instead? How do you get that shift in motion?
Sometimes you have to show them by example. Often I'll bring in what I call a third party story. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great marketing company, it's multi-generational. Here are some difficult changes and decisions they had to make together. Don't know if that applies to you or if you'd even be willing. Maybe you're not. I have to ask them the tough questions. And one of my favorite questions, and I hope people, I want to hear this out in the business world more. That could be, let's pretend for a minute that may not be true. Then what? Now, if we build a decent rapport and we spend a little time together, I can ask the tough questions. Right? Because as you do, I do as well. In the beginning, we ask tough questions. And if they're not comfortable with that, then it's probably not a good match.
Yeah. Yeah. As we're talking, I'm thinking about a recent prospect call I had, and it's between us and one more, and we whittled down the field from 5 to 2. And I probably could have asked a few more tough questions in that last call, but we'll see. We'll see.
And I'm with you. I've got 2, and I let it go for a little while. I finally sent him a video saying, my suspicion is either you've decided not to do it because you're too busy, you've decided you're good enough and you don't want the help that either of these companies, or you just didn't get around to it yet. I got a call back within 2 hours. Hell, you're right. We didn't get to it yet. But I had some head trash around that. I wanted it. I didn't.
Yeah.
So it's about taking that. We just have to take action and quit making excuses for not taking action. Picking up the phone, making the video, whatever it is.
I get it. This is another question I have that shows up a lot, especially for older companies where there might be a new generation in play or coming into play, or even the third generation, maybe your fourth. So this comes with advising that younger leader who is trying to introduce some structure and accountability to, I'll just say, a veteran or legacy sales team. He's basically saying, we're doing it. And you've probably even seen this, Cal, if you could comment, where you've got old guard sales and then the new guard. And I've actually seen this play out in companies where it's literally, it's almost like two different camps. So what do you do when you run into that, when there's this movement to let's bring some change and accountability, but you've got these, and again, no disrespect to the legacy sales professionals, they're tested in battle. They've done great things for that company. They've won some major business. They're not like just sitting on the sidelines. They're just set in their ways.
Yeah. Well, how much time do we have, Ed? That's a big one. The first thing I think is leadership, because often, not always, but often, and it could be family, could not be, but I find it more in family businesses, is that the new person coming in, in fact, there's a great example of called a large trade company. And young guy comes in, super smart, he's done great, but he's coming in believing he needs to be the boss versus what we teach in our management leadership programs, the coach, the listener. There's a boss role and trainer to some degree. So going in or being the boss and taking that autocratic charge like some past generations did doesn't really work. So I think that's one for the leader. As for the old guy, there's no answer for that. Although there was a guy and I saw it coming. He said, Cal, my company made me come to this training. I've been doing this 29 years, so I'm sure I'll come up with something or a refresher. I'm like, all right, here it comes. That's fine. At the end, we do lessons learned. And he said, I've got one. Now, I've been selling wrong for 29 years. This is so much smarter. It was going to be so much easier. Now, not everybody said that in that group, and we had about half and half. I get a lot of mileage out of that story, and some do and some won't. I'm giving too long an answer, but sometimes you're going to make some tough decisions. Is this the kind of role model I want in this organization if we're going to go from here to here? Sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. That's just a tough call to make.
Yeah, yeah. And it's challenging too, because in a lot of technical sales, there's just a range of bringing on a new selling professional, a young selling professional, when there is a bit of nuance or technology involved in the sale. It's teaching them what the heck it is the company does and then figuring out, all right, do they have the acumen to go and sell what the company does? It's really two pieces of the puzzle. At least I've always seen it that way. Would you be inclined to agree, or do you see it differently?
It's tough. So very technical sales. Most of the companies I work with that have very technical sales, we help the, I guess, two things. We help the salespeople who don't know the stuff very well have the initial conversation and then bring a technical person in. They get to do early stage disqualifying. The other is two companies we work with now. They've got technical account managers, or TAM is the acronym. And we actually work with them to learn how to do a lot of prospecting. What's an upfront contract? How do I ask questions to get pain and understand the problem versus hear just enough to pitch them a solution? Right, technical people are there to solve problems and they tend to pitch a solution. We know that's not the right approach. So as soon as they get that, they are fantastic in a sales role that would never call it that because they get upset.
Yes, I was going to say, just call it anything you want. Just don't call it selling.
I'll call it sales even this afternoon, as a matter of fact. And we're doing all that. I've taken sales out of all my stuff. But
so we see this a lot, and I'm sure you've seen this too. Somebody says, I've got to hire a salesperson. I need more salespeople. And then there's tremendous churn. They come in, they cycle out, come in, cycle out. What is it? Why is that? What's going on there that they're missing or that somebody's missing? What's the missing ingredient there that creates that churn in that role?
Yeah, it's always the leader's fault, number one. Nobody ever wants to hear that. I find it's people have, well, in sales, we know people make decisions emotionally and justify them intellectually. Sales hires, especially any hire, we need to make that decision intellectually based on what are the skills, what are the all the things that they have that we have identified. And for me, and we've talked about these before, I always use a predictive analytical tool, so it takes my emotion out of it. So I've got a couple of those. Obviously, we all have as entrepreneurs, we've got gut feel. My gut's at about 68%, which is awesome for baseball, not much for sales hires. No. And I think if we're more objective about that, and then we have great onboarding, the percentage success rate is higher. Sales is sales. There's always going to be some churn.
Yeah. As there will in other roles too. But
in other roles, it's about being unemotional and objective. Yeah. I hired somebody not too long ago. They're gone now. It wasn't a good personality fit. It didn't matter. I didn't care how that person did it. She followed the process and did what she needed to do, but we were very different in our styles. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. When I take emotion out of it, there's definitely people that on emotion, on gut, I maybe wouldn't have hired who turned out to be awesome employees because the acumen and the data said, this is a good choice. In that case, don't trust your gut. Trust the data that this is a very smart individual, very talented, very capable, who's going to do good things. And as long as you're aligned either close enough on values, you know, so you don't have to be perfect, but close enough, you're going to do okay. And that proved to be true.
Yeah, it is. But I actually have one friend and client, and we use DISC. And those mm-hmm. who know DISC will know what I'm talking about. But she will not hire someone who's high on the DISC scale. Direct, loud, in your face, bullet points, get just to make her and the team uncomfortable. She's been unwilling to do that, which that's a choice. They're mm-hmm. doing fine. But that's, I think they might need a little bit of that. We all have our biases and we're all going to make our decisions. And
yeah,
we got a lot of answers, you and I, but we don't have all of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's turn our attention to technology for a moment. The technology has certainly had influence on how people sell, right? Let me get your take, Al. Do you think that the digital tools and especially AI are making good sellers better, or are they in some cases replacing what should be a real human-to-human conversation?
Yeah. I've never heard that question before. And we talk about this probably 5 times a week. And other than a B2B store or a B2C store where you go online,
yeah,
the salesperson is not going away. And I loved your first statement. They're going to make the good ones better. If we're mm-hmm. not using tools, then we're going to get beat by the people who are using the tools. I think that's the difference. And that's been my experience. My sales process, the process is the same. The execution takes me about half the time than it did 2.5 years ago. And I have a higher close rate. It's more effective. And I don't have to take notes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. When it comes to, at least my experience, when it comes to sales teams and CRMs, I don't think I've ever met a high level selling professional who doesn't make use of, and I don't care which one it is, but a CRM. Yet there's such resistance. So what's your position on the use or not use of CRMs in the selling process as a backbone to that person's selling?
Same exact observation. And again, some people have really sophisticated spreadsheets. That's not great for legacy movement, right? Yeah. You lose the data.
Yeah.
But I'll give you an example. I've introduced something that I use. Can I name names of programs or wanting me to be generic?
You can name names.
All right. Anyway, I use a recorder on Zoom calls. Of course, it summarizes it. That's pretty easy. It also has a Sandler button, and it's called Fathom, like water, Fathom. There's a Sandler button in that, and it records and puts things in the slot in the Sandler system.
Oh.
It automatically imports into the CRM. It automatically assigns tasks to me or somebody else who's in the organization. I can then go review the pain points and the challenges, cut them and paste them into our draft agreement. And it does some other things on the back end. So just that alone. And we have five different sales teams, they've adopted that or a form of it because it's easier. They don't even have to do much in the CRM except track stuff. And now they're tricked into doing it because all the information's there. This is what I had to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the I have to, there's no information anyplace except in there. So now I have to go. And it has literally cut my sales cycle by 50% in 2 years.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah. And a lot of the grunt work. Yeah.
I don't like it either, but now I don't really have to do much of it.
Yeah. Because the rationale, I think, for the resistance to a CRM is probably coming from a good place. A good sales professional wants to be doing what? Outselling. They don't want to be taking notes and doing administrative tasks because that's not fun.
That's the argument for sure. But I think if people can recognize that they're more effective and more efficient, oddly enough. But you're right. People have been fighting me on that for 15 years. So, our clients are also now more successful by doing that. And it's a thing.
So you just brought up a great instance of how AI is being really interwoven into the Sandler framework. Are there other areas or other instances where AI is showing up in the Sandler model in and of itself?
So many. AI assistants. I've got a number of colleagues who have developed, because they've got really smart AI clients, who have helped them develop little AI assistants. So this is even advanced for me. I'm not an early adopter. But this stuff was just, I had to do it because I'm lazy. I don't like this stuff. So one friend of mine, she wakes up in the morning, does her morning routine or stretching or exercise. After the first cup of coffee, she presses, I don't know what the app is, but it tells her about her day, things she needs to think about, what's on the calendar for the next couple of days, and tells her some things to think about, to check on, people to talk to. And it's as if you have your own administrative debriefing or pre-briefing every single morning at 7:15. That's just crazy to me. I'm not there yet, but I know people who use it.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
There are other things. So there's some predictive analytics based on the input into your CRM that, if you follow the process, will tell you the likelihood of closing this deal, and it helps aid in forecasting.
Yeah.
So you know what forecasting sounds like. Hey, Johnny came to me. He's got 60 million this year or 600,000 this year. He's a sandbagger. I know there's more opportunity, so I'm going to set his quota for 75. Or, right, it's a sales manager's nightmare. So there's some of that we use as well. So there's a lot. We can spend, that's another hour to talk about. Yeah.
Forecasting's always been a tricky one because I think it's often grounded in fantasy.
Of course.
And back to a previous point, hope instead of strategy.
Opium, exactly.
But yes, we could talk about that at length. But let's touch on another Sandler cornerstone, and that's the idea of attitude, behavior, and technique, and the three of those needing to work in some level of harmony to achieve success. So when you see a company that's hitting some form of plateau, it could be a growth plateau or they're topping out somewhere, is it one of those attributes that's breaking down, or are they all breaking down, or is it something else that you often see when they're hitting that? It's a family business. They've been around for years. They've had a nice growth run. They've been going 20% year over year for a number of years. They think there's no end in sight to this trajectory. And then boom, suddenly stops. What's going on there sometimes?
Boy, my belief is all three are equal. Most of the world believes 78% is all technique. Can you come in and give us new things to say and techniques to do, and people will fold like a cheap suit and give us their checkbook? The answer is no. My belief, long-held belief, is it's about behavior and taking the action we need to take. If I take some actions, Ed, and you know this one, if I take some actions, even that I don't want to go take. All the guys this afternoon, total introvert, very technical. He so doesn't want to go on a podcast. But he did one. He sent it to his entire network. We did some marketing. They, not me, they did some marketing around it. He got four appointments and closed one deal just from doing a podcast that he was uncomfortable with. So that now has changed his belief system. He used to think that stuff doesn't work and I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And there's also a lot of technique that we build in there, but technique is no good if you're not doing the behaviors.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they all work together. Yeah.
Part of the attitude too, I think, is also, and you hear this a lot in sports, you hear this in selling, trust the process, you know, trust the process, because we've all had those weeks where it seems like, and I certainly have, where I'm like, I think I would have been more effective today if I stayed home, because I feel like I'm paddling through mud and I'm going backwards, not forwards, with every stroke. And those days will happen. And that's when I'm reminded, trust the process.
Tomorrow, the process, even if you don't feel like it. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure you've seen that people want to just bail out because like they didn't have that immediate success. And that's what everybody seems to want today is immediate success. But it doesn't work that way, does it?
No, I don't. So I've got a great client. They say, we now understand what slow down the process in order to speed it up. Sometimes we had to slow it down to speed it up.
It's a great insight.
Services company. They will now not have the meeting, the third meeting, without a certain one of the leaders in the room. And it's annoyed some people because that's how they're used to buying. But when you're in control of the selling process, you call the shots. And if they're not willing to follow your process, you probably don't want to work with them. And that's an attitude belief system. And it's worked for me sometimes.
Yeah.
John's going to be there. We're going to have to postpone the meeting.
Yeah. And it's great. It's a great discipline because when I was young in my career, if somebody asked me for a proposal, I couldn't wait to shoot that thing off.
Yeah.
And then it's, and now I'm waiting and waiting.
What are you hoping I'm going to propose to? Just one of your programs. It's good for sales. They're all good for sales, but I don't know what you want to accomplish. I'll send you the wrong one probably. What? You have your calendar open? Sure. Let's pick a time for 45 minutes next week and I can tell you whether I can help you or not. Yeah. And it's shocking to people.
Yeah.
But when we take control, and I think this is also harder for long established family businesses because they've been doing things the same way. Not all of them. I've got some really progressive ones. They might see this, so I can't name them, but there are people that are really progressive and they change and they know change and they push for change. They're not worried about family disagreements a little bit. And others just, they're not willing to challenge the status quo. And in any case, I never think that's good, but I'm heavily biased.
Yeah. Understood. So when it comes to your role, a lot of times there's that difference between what maybe a family business leader wants to hear, but then there's what they need to hear. So can you reflect on maybe a hard truth you've had to deliver to a family business leader, something they didn't want to hear, but needed to hear?
And that's exactly what I say. So there are going to be some times and we may not want to move forward because my job is to tell you, these are almost my words, Ed, you have them. What you need to hear, not what you want to hear. I'm really bad, you can ask my father, at telling people what they want to hear. Never been in my wheelhouse since I was born. That's what makes our process, according to our clients, really good at helping them because we will tell them the hard truth.
Yeah.
And sales, by the way, for me is, it's about having adult conversations to get to the truth, not appeasing somebody so they'll buy something from us.
Yeah.
Whether they need it. You nail it. It's exactly that.
Yeah. And I like the way you framed it as very much an upfront contract or upfront expectation. Here's how it's going to be.
Yeah.
Said. So if a parent came to you and said, hey, my son or daughter is joining the business, what advice would you give relative to the importance of giving that younger next generation some sales acumen, i.e. some sales training? Because typically when somebody's coming into the business, they're getting exposure to all facets of the business, the operations, the servicing, client interactions, personnel interactions, financial interactions, and certainly sales and marketing interactions are going to be in the mix. So when they're saying, hey, I'm thinking about bringing my son, my daughter into the business, or they are joining, what advice would you give about giving them some sales acumen?
Yeah. So I'm going to ask them why. No one expects that. Or they give an answer, or I'll say, tell me a little more about that. But I think here's one, and I violate this rule every 2.5, every 3 years. I did the math, and it always bites me in the butt. And that is, that's great. We'll talk a little bit about that. Here's the rub. The owner of the leadership needs to be involved. And you probably know why. And some will go, I have no idea why. And others go, yeah, because if you're teaching them one thing and I'm telling them something else, where do you think it's going to go? Where do you think it's going to go over Thanksgiving dinner? I'm not going to be there. So It's very important for me. In fact, it's a requirement, and I will often remember to tell people that the leader has to be involved in some way, either join our Essentials program, or we have every couple of coaching sessions so they know that when this person comes in and said, I talked to Ed D'Elia and I disqualified him because we don't want to sell to him. It's the wrong match. And the owner loses his mind. You say, you can't disqualify people, right? So we can't have those kind of conflicts, or don't even bother to bring me in because it's not going to help you.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've probably seen this one too. Great sales professional in an organization, right? The organization's growing. They're bringing on more sales professionals, right? Because they're growing. So what should we do in terms of sales? We'll take the best seller and make them the leader, right? Because they're the best at selling. So they've naturally got to be the VP of sales or the director of sales and oversee the rest. Talk about that for a minute. Is that always the right recipe?
I'd say 90-something% of the time it's the wrong recipe.
Okay.
And the answer is why? They're the best salesperson. Why? Because they do this. What are they going to tell their salespeople? Do what I do. Do it how I do. And that's right, everybody. I mean, Sandler's a process, a system. We've got attitude, behavior, technique. We're going to use all that. But the way you use it, Ed, is different than the way I apply it. We have different personalities. And the worst thing in the world you can do is so there's a couple of problems. I take my best producer off the street, make him manage people for which he has almost no skill set for. Now we've annoyed the entire sales team by, there's just everything wrong with that. Now, it can work. We have 3 people in our management program and they're getting it and they understand it and they're embracing it. The leader's involved. They're also seller doers, because when you do that, they're seller managers. That's the thing. It's like having one foot on the boat, 1 foot on the dock. You've got conflicting priorities. So it's, people do it all the time.
Yes, they
do.
It's
not optimal, but it's hard to find a good sales manager that is good at holding people accountable. It's hard. So the default is take my best person, make them the manager. I've seen it work about 10, maybe 15% of the time.
I see it metaphorically when I started coaching youth baseball. So I played baseball through the ranks. And I remember, I think it was the night before our first practice. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, and I was like, had a sleepless night because I'm realized, yeah, I know how to do this, but I have no idea how to explain that to an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old.
That's the perfect example, Ed. Yep.
So shortly thereafter, I'm like, I need to learn how to coach 8- and 9-year-olds. I need to get some education. And I realized it's a total different experience and curriculum than the doing. The teaching is so much different than the doing. Yes, you demonstrate, but it's more about the vocabulary that you create with them and how you bring them along and patience and going over it again and again, which some people don't have the patience for, quite honestly. They say, this kid can't play. No, the kid can play. They just don't have, they're still developing their skills. And the more that I can bring that to the business world, I think the better off I am, because it teaches, reminds me of patience and bringing people along. But yeah, different skills altogether.
That's a great story. And if you look at all the great baseball players and baseball coaches, historically, they're not ever the same people. There are a few exceptions.
Couple.
But not many.
And I think the only time where they bridge that gap is if they, too, learned the art and science of coaching versus playing as a different skill set. And I think the same is true based on this conversation and in selling. You can't just take the top producer and say, all right, you're in charge.
Now, mine was the opposite. As 30 years ago, I was in procurement, so I don't even like salespeople. But I wasn't a great buyer either, because it required a lot of real detail orientation. So I actually became the manager. And I didn't help with the buying part. I helped with the leading and the creating and the coaching. I was way better at that than being a doer. I was not good at being the doer. I've seen people take terrible salespeople and make them good sales managers, actually. As counterintuitive as that seems, I've absolutely seen that work.
Cool.
Wrong person in the wrong hole.
Yeah. So to date, you've trained, it's got to be in the thousands of sales professionals, and you've taught them a lot of things. And one of the things that I know through the Sandler process you taught was how to ask great questions, right? So for our listeners, if you could impart one great Sandler question that everyone listening should be tuned into, if you had to pick one, what would be that question?
I'm going to do a mini role play. You don't have to answer. I'm going to say, Ed, that's an insightful question. I love it. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean? And then just stop, shut up, and let them talk. Because as if you ask somebody, tell me a little more about that, what are they going to do? They're going to tell us more about that. And that gets us out of solutioning too soon. But for me, and it seems so simple, but in my experience as a buyer of things, nobody asks me about, tell me more, or why is that, or why is that important to you? So I think that's the number one. That's great. Tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And so so often overlooked, and even for those of us that are Sandler trained. And that's why we keep coming back, because just like a professional athlete, the coaching and the practice never stops, does it? And a professional seller who wants to operate at a high level, their journey can't ever stop when it comes to learning and perfecting their skills. And that's why
it's all about reinforcement. Yeah. I just talked with a client. They've been off and on clients for 15 years, Ed. And he said, hey, I think we're getting a little rusty. Can the five of us come back and do some private interactions? Tell me more about that. Why would you want to do that? And he did.
Yeah.
And it was that. And he knows this well. He didn't see it coming. He said, yeah, this. Here's why.
Yeah. And that's one of the fascinating things about the Sandler process that I've always found is that you could be talking and interacting with a prospect who is also Sandler trained, and it still works, because they might know it and they might be amused by it, but it's still, the effect is still the same, and it doesn't really matter, because once they're in the channel, they're in the channel.
You're so right about that. And sometimes they recognize it, sometimes they don't. We have an annual client summit in Fort Lauderdale this year, and sneaky plug, I was actually selected to be a speaker as of Friday. But that, right? These are well-trained clients. They've got a room full of 2,000 prospects, and they are doing it to each other. And there's a lot of business done, a lot of prospecting done, a lot of business gets done at that conference, because they all get it. And so that's fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
And it's, I think, Ed, because it's so honest and legitimate, I really don't understand the question. I really do want to know more, so I can give you an answer, or maybe I can't.
Yeah.
Until I find out what you really mean. Anyway, that's my thought. I'm going on.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
But that's a great takeaway. Last question. For any of our listeners who want to learn more about Sandler or connect with you directly, what's the best way to reach you, Cal?
I'm a big phone guy. Pick up the phone, give me a call. My email is cal.thomas@sandler.com. I'm on LinkedIn, pretty visible there. And I have an office in Morristown. So Sandler Morristown, you'll find me there. We do a lot of talks. Ask Ed. Ed's been a great practitioner for sure. He'll tell you the truth. So if you don't trust me, talk to Ed or someone else who's participated in Sandler. I think that's probably the best approach, in my opinion, Ed.
Awesome. Okay. Thank you. Cal, gosh, this has been a fantastic conversation. You've helped us uncover why so many businesses, and specifically family businesses, struggle to get their sales process right, and what they can do to start using sales and the process to drive and lead growth instead of being reactionary. Your insights into behavior, mindset, and communication across generations are also invaluable for leaders who are looking to build something lasting that goes beyond them. So thanks again for joining me. Again, for our listeners, we've been speaking with Cal Thomas, a trainer at Sandler Training, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been Growing Up B2B. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Cal, thank you so much for being with us today. Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.delianet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn, and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at delianet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.